Hello and welcome to the Money Marketing Podcast. I'm Kimberly Dondo, and in today's episode, I'm joined by our amazing editorial team, well, part of our amazing editorial team for our end of month podcast. So before we get started, I'm just going to let everyone else introduce themselves. Dan, do you want to start?
Hi, everyone. I'm Dan Cooper. I'm the news editor at Money Marketing.
Hi, I'm Maria Nichols, features editor at Money Marketing.
And I'm Amanda Newman-Smith, feature writer.
Amazing. Thank you all for joining me today. So before we kind of get into May, let's talk a little bit more in depth about April and everything that you covered in April that was fascinating or scandalous, I don't know. Amanda, do you want to start us off?
Okay, yeah. Well, I was really personally invested in this feature that I wrote for the, you know, it's the InFocus, it's diversity in the recruitment process, because I often come across advisors who say to me, you know, we really want to be diverse, you know, our door's open to everybody, but we're just not getting the applicants through. And I just thought, you know, to me, like coming from a working class background where, you know, we didn't know what financial advisors were sort of back then. And it just seems to me that you need to kind of cast your net more widely. So, you know, the obvious thing is like job adverts, you know, if you sort of place it, I don't know, in the posh papers, you know what I mean, like yeah, certain kind of person's going to see it. And you know, I started this article with a quote from someone I spoke to, Natalie Richards, who is chief executive of SEO London, my mistake there. That's a diversity in education and training charity. And she told me that during the interview, you know, talent is everywhere, but opportunity is not. And I just thought that really sort of summarizes the issue here. You know, if you kind of look in the same kind of places for candidates, then, you know, don't be surprised when the same kind of people walk through the door. So I've been looking at, you know, how things like language, you know, wording of job adverts can sort of, you know, put people off, because one recruitment consultant told me, you know, if you kind of, you know, put language like, you know, competitive driven, whatever, you know, they're not necessarily gendered terms. You know, a woman can be competitive driven, whatever, but, you know, statistically speaking, you know, it does kind of appeal to more men. And, you know, you might find that, you know, however good a woman is at her job, she might be put off by this environment. Another person told me, you know, you only apply for a job when you think you're going to fit in. And I think that's kind of why it kind of, you know, if you put this kind of, I suppose, excessively salesy kind of culture, then it can put people off, you know, not just women, but, you know, it can put sort of other people off. And I just think, you know, firms need to probably take a bit more care, you know, where they kind of advertise, or, you know, where they look for new candidates, and how they're sort of couching those terms, and also accessibility, you know, because as well, like, you know, if you're disabled or whatever, or, you know, you've got some sort of impairment, there are, you know, you need a bit of help in accessing things sometime. And, you know, it would be good if people could sort of, you know, put together some, I don't know, dyslexia friendly materials or something, you know, to kind of widen that net a bit. Because, you know, they're all sort of, seems to me everyone's sort of scratching their heads going, oh, I don't know why I'm getting, you know, same sort of people through the door. You know, do my best, you know, we welcome everybody, but, you know, it's just not happening. So,
well, I think, isn't it that saying that's like, if you do the same thing over and over again, it's like a sign of madness, like you're not going to get different results. So I can only imagine that if you put out the same traditional kind of job advert, and I have to say a lot of like job adverts, they do tend to use language where you're like, I don't even know if I have that skill, or the way that it's worded, it makes it sound more higher level than it actually is. Maybe they're actually just asking for someone who can use Excel and put in numbers, but they've worded it in such a way that makes it seem like it's a super tricky technical mathematic thing.
No, I agree with you then. Sometimes job title, I mean, this is probably going off the point for financial advice, but sometimes job titles can be very, like, they seem quite highbrow, don't they? And you look at that and think, oh my God, like, I'm way off that. But when actually, when you boil it down, it's probably something you could do.
Yeah, I think also I used to work for an HR magazine, so we would talk a lot. And the way that they tried to, I don't know, spice up an HR job title role was always so funny. It was like head of people or something like that. Yeah. Just to, and then it just made me think that if you're searching for that type of job, how are you going to find it if it says head of people? Because I didn't type in that I'm looking
to be
for
head of people.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So there is that aspect where I think a lot of different companies now are trying to change the names of traditional job titles and make them sound, I don't know, like more cool and fun. But it might mean that you're missing out on a great pool of people that aren't looking into that.
Agreed. And can I make one final point on that? You know, if you really don't know where to start, I've been told, you know, organizations can help. I mean, the one that comes to mind is Kaleidoscope, the disability charity. They're working with SJP on, you know, sort of placing candidates and that sort of thing. So, you know, there is help out there. And SEO London as well do that. So they've got, like, you know, they know some talented people who could be really good in your organization. So, you know, I'd say look around for organizations like that if you're really struggling.
Mm-hmm. And Maria, was there anything in April that stood out for you?
I think big talking point at the moment is the UK ISA, and I wanted to have a look really about some of the pros and cons there. Mm-hmm. I mean, as we all know, it was announced in the budget in March, but obviously since then there's been more analysis and reaction to come, which has been interesting. I think it's fair to say that there's not a lot of supporters. Yeah, the majority are kind of thrashing it, really. But last month we had a really interesting column written by Quilter Chief Executive Steve Levine. Mm-hmm. And there was some numbers in there that I hadn't seen before, which I thought were really interesting. So he points to the figures that were bandied around in the run-up to the budget, suggesting that the ISA could raise $200 billion for UK PLC over 5 years. Sounds really impressive. I think, like, the idea behind it is really laudable, but he has run some analysis on this and he says it's a ridiculous overestimate and very misleading. And the reason being, so I'm just going to read out this paragraph. It relies on the idea that if cash savers invested 5,000 into UK companies, it would deliver that sum. This assumption draws on FCA data indicating 8.4 million people possess 10,000 or more in cash assets available for investment. Mm-hmm. So if each were to invest 5,000 in the UK ISA, it could potentially generate 210 billion over 5 years. So that's saying that 10,000, they've still got 10,000 left in their ISA to use. Who's to say that's going to go to UK? So when you look at it like that, I mean, we shouldn't be surprised that politicians...
It makes it, murky, it's a callback to that Brexit bus with, like, the amount of money that would go back into the NHS. It's giving that very much. Yeah. That's like, when you look at it, it's like, are these people actually of that percentage of people that could put that 5,000, how many of them will choose to allocate their assets into that?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that another figure that struck me was only 15% of ISA investors are maximising their contributions at the moment. So there's only 15% of ISA investors. I mean, how many people in the country aren't investing in ISAs? And then only 15% of that are at the 20,000 limit. So I think he said, it could potentially generate around 8 billion annually. So, which is no small sum, but... Yeah, it's all a bit misleading. At the end of the day, they're only shooting themselves in the foot, really, because...
I think they want to at this point.
That's it. I don't know what they're trying to prove. But anyway, so that was quite interesting to come from him. I also just wanted to flag up next month our senior reporter, Lois Spilelli. She's written a really interesting kind of... comeback to this, not comeback, but she's presenting the other side of the argument, and I think that's really interesting. So she's saying, don't knock it till you've tried it, basically. Specifically, as an independent advisor, be careful showing your hand too early, because you have to be seen to take on whole of market. And the product itself, the UK ISA, is still under consultation, so, you know, we don't know what's going to come out. It might be positive. Yeah, she's basically saying, you know, should we give it a chance? So that's really interesting. It's actually one of the only kind of positive spins that I've seen on it. I mean, yeah, I trust Lois to come up with the with the controversial viewpoint of it. But yeah, I don't know. What do I think? I think will we even see the light of day of this product? You know, we're in general election year, it's still under consultation, so yeah. This could all be completely futile. We're seeing lots and lots of talk about it, but it could all be futile. It is confusing. There's an awful lot of ices out there now. You know, even as someone in the industry, it just blows my mind a little bit and makes it all seem a little bit off-putting. So what's to be said for, you know, your standard person in the street? But yeah, I don't know.
it does make me think back to 2018, I think, when the Lifetime ISA was introduced, and a lot of people were also very skeptical of that, and they thought it was like some commiseration thing, and it wasn't really going to be super effective for a lot of people. They didn't think it was going to be a product that people took advantage of, but I've seen a lot of people use it, mostly because of the fact that if you're someone like me, you have a tendency to put stuff in savings and then be like, oh, actually, I really want to spend money on this, and then end up pulling out of it. Whereas, you know, there's restrictions with the Lifetime ISA. You can only take out once you're, you know, purchasing a home or I can't remember what the other thing is, but like, you can only take it out once. So
they have to buy that. They have to buy ISA. I mean, that really helped me buy. that was absolutely brilliant, but that was beneficial to the saver, same as the Lifetime ISA. It's beneficial to the saver. What benefits is the saver going to get from the UK ISA? You know, in actual fact, you could say from the opposite side, should there be concerns of investors kind of being forced into investing into a subpar market, which the UK is?
But I mean, I understand the concept behind it, like putting more money into UK businesses will help the economy. But I think someone made a point that like a lot of UK businesses aren't just UK based. They're also international. So, you know,
we think HSBC, for example, you know, one of the biggest UK entities that derives, I think it was 80% of its profits from overseas. So, that's one of the things that's under consultation, what is going to constitute as a UK company, and actually coming from that consultation, there may be, you know, it may be beneficial to smaller UK companies, and you know, that's great, but yeah, we'll just have to see on that. There's loads of alternatives. I think, you know, like you just said, the idea of boosting UK investment is a great idea, but is there better ways that it could be
done? Some people have been pitching that, like, pensions, you know, maybe they could drive more of their investments directly to UK companies. Like, that makes sense. That's a big pull for me. That's just there.
Yeah, that's the matching house reforms, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, hey, I don't know. I don't make these decisions.
What do we know?
We just write about it. But Dan, what about you? You were part of the duo that wrote the April cover.
The April one was just me, and the May one was myself.
Oh,
and
Lois, yeah, sorry.
On a joint effort. No, it's fine. I can't take all the credit for me. the April cover. I came into this podcast saying, I'm not going to bang on about pensions. I'm not going to mention pensions. So guess what I'm going to do? I'm going to mention pensions. the April cover really was just looking at the sort of the pensions crisis that we find ourselves in at the moment. And you know, although it's kind of not a new issue, it's been something that's been spoken about for a fair few years now. Just that we've really kind of hit a crisis point, and where do we go from here? Because some of the stats are quite frightening, really. It was 3.5 million working age people aren't saving anything at all into their pension. And then 61% of people are saving below the 8% that is recommended. And then 87% of people who are saving less than 15%. So it's obviously the stats are quite alarming, but it's kind of, well, where do you go from here? What do you do next? So it was just exploring that really, and looking at perhaps, you know, the option to look at other countries, and I think the likes of the Netherlands, that they've consistently kind of topped the pensions tables in terms of you know, value. So it's maybe looking at some inspiration from abroad and where we can maybe apply that here somehow. The other argument is kind of the auto enrollment and whether it's time for an auto enrollment review. You know, although it's working really, really well, and it's getting millions more saving than it was previously, it's as I said, it's not kind of going far enough. But it's that difficult balance between, you know, we're in a cost of living crisis at the moment, and you know, a lot of people just don't have that disposable income to put more money aside. You know, they're using it for day to day living. And I think in fact, one of the stories we did recently was that, you know, more and more people are actually using their savings to help with the cost of day to day living. So, it's just a question of, well, how do we get people saving more money? It's like the million-pound question at the moment. So that was kind of that was one of the things that stood out for me in April. The other ones I wanted to mention were a story that a leader that our senior reporter Mamadou wrote around income protection, and how the you know, traditionally they're sort of seen as the protection underdog in recent years, with you know, sales not being particularly high, but it's kind of seen a bit of a resurgence and recently, and you know, a lot of that is down to sort of a post-COVID rise in sickness. That was one of the factors, right, that Mamadou looked into, and how I think it was 2.1 million adults were economically inactive pre-pandemic, and it's now sort of 2.8 million in 2003, so it's gone up by 700,000 you know, sort of post-COVID, and that's one of the factors where, you know, IP sales are kind of really booming at the moment. Other issues, yeah, you know, other sort of factors are the consumer duty, and just that people are kind of shouting about income protection a bit more now.
Yeah.
But that, yeah, that they were sort of two of the main stories for me that stood out in April.
I never know.
Interesting. So I was just going to say, that's so interesting looking at the contrast of those two stories. So,
yeah,
you know, we're saying the cost of living crisis, no one can spare a few, and we feel it. No one can spare those few extra pounds for pensions or to put away for pensions. But actually, that IP is, I mean, it must be one of the only financial products that are seeing an upward trend, right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, it's interesting. You're going back to pensions as well.
I think maybe it might relate to that thing that Lois talked about, where, you know, envisioning your future self is very difficult. So I can't see myself, like, my parents are almost in their 60s, but I can't see myself at their stage, because I honestly, looking at the state of the world, sometimes I'm like, I don't know if we have another 20 years on this planet. But I think maybe sometimes it's difficult to be like, oh, I'm going to put extra aside for my retirement, because you don't know if that will be a possibility, or you might just be like, ah, it'll work out, something will happen, someone will have to look after me. But I think when it comes to income protection, maybe the fear of what happened during COVID made it a reality that this could be something that happens at any point in the near future. So you're able to envision that more, where you're like, I need to make sure that I have a backup now.
Yeah. It's just kind of put that at the forefront. I think COVID, like you say, Kim, has put that at the forefront of people's minds now, hasn't it? Where perhaps they weren't thinking about these issues before, but, you know, it's become more apparent now, and more, yeah, I need to kind of put steps in place to help.
Yeah, I think they just need to remarket pensions and make it like,
I can't understand.
Make it work, Kim. That's the million.
I don't make it so that people understand the necessity of it, and be like, if you don't, you know, like how a lot of advisors always say when they use cash flow modeling, that's when their clients are able to understand in 20 years, if I do this with my money, this is where I'll be. I think if everyday people who might not have a financial advisor were able to have that like graph that showed if you add just an extra 20 quid or I don't know how much, this is where you'll be at in 2040, I think maybe that might help a little bit.
I think what's really difficult is, I don't know about you, but so I look at my parents and you know, that generation of the people that I know, and we're seeing, like, God, we've got family friends, they're on holiday. I mean, they're on serious holidays. They're in their 60s every month because of massive DB pensions and massive property price increases. So that's what we're seeing. So it's that whole kind of, you know, making it real, making it tangible for us. We can't, well, it's hard to see how difficult life is going to be. And also they've got state pensions at, you know, much younger than what we can expect and what our generation and future generations can expect. So it's that making it tangible, isn't it? Because at the moment, I guess it's kind of a human nature thing to think, oh, we'll be fine because like, they're fine and they're having a great time. And even if they haven't got those massive, you know, final salary pensions and they're not on all these retirement holidays and cruises, they're comfortable because they're in a hut, they're sitting on an asset. Well, most people are sitting in an asset worth, you know, more than we
millions.
Can
yeah. Yeah, that's so true. That is probably it, like where I'm like, I can't really envision like where my parents are. Because they're comfortable, they're fine, and they will be fine. And they had kids, so that's also in my culture, that's like your retirement.
Oh really?
Essentially, like my grandparents, they never had a pension in Zimbabwe. Mm. Like they didn't put money aside for their retirement. Their retirement was on my dad's side, their 9 kids, and on my mom's side, with my grandma. My mom's mom, they had 5 kids, and then my granddad had a second wife, so he has more kids. So he was like, I'll always be fine. Like my kids are all gonna come together. And it's true, because my dad and his siblings all helped to look after my grandparents who are still living. And when my mom's parents were still alive, they were also being looked after by her and her siblings. So I guess that was like the old form of a pension. But now, as we move away from that kind of community-based living where it's more independent in Western cultures, we all now have to think more about that. But I think there's a part of me that's always like, I'll just go back home and live on the farm if it's really that bad.
I do agree, but what you're both saying, Kim and Maria, I mean, just a way of, you know, I know this is probably being done more now, but a way of just simplifying it, saying, you know, you need X amount, you know, to retire comfortably or moderately or however you want to phrase it. Mm-hmm. This is the amount you need. This is how much you need to put by per month. Mm-hmm. And this is when you need to start. I'm sure this is being done more and more, but that was one of the things we kind of looked at in the April cover was you know, kind of how much money you need for each of those things. I think it was the PLSA who released their retirement living standards report, which I think is an annual report. And for a minimum standard of living in retirement, I think a single person needs $14,400 a year. For a moderate, it's $31,300 a year. For a comfortable retirement, it's $43,100 a year. So, and that the comfortable one includes a subscription to a streaming service.
Yeah.
Regular beauty treatments, a foreign holiday, and several UK mini breaks a year. So,
that's
you're talking about the so £43,000 a year is what you need, Kim.
Oh man!
It made me laugh at the allowance that they gave for food though on those PLSA. The food spend that they've put down was like double what I spend for a family of four each week.
Yeah, but maybe they're doing that like with inflation and how much food might cost and like shipping and stuff, because not a lot, especially in the UK, not a lot of it is like locally sourced. I don't know.
Well, they just say something about lobster and caviar every Sunday.
Sorry.
Oh, man. Oh, Dan, now you just made me think either I have to downsize my skincare products or...
Sorry. Put a downer on your Wednesday. Sorry, Kim.
Yeah, that's or, you know, now I just have to get into hustle culture and I have to hustle more, have multiple streams of income so I can do this comfortable retirement saving.
Well, apparently, if you want to be I think I've mentioned this in a previous podcast, so again, I'll probably sound like a broken record, but if you want to be a pensions millionaire, i.e. have a £1 million pot to retire with, I think they worked out that you need to save £440 a month from your early 20s.
Oh, wow.
Missed the boat. I've long missed the boat, honestly. Long missed it.
Okay. Well, apart from maybe playing the lottery, I don't know. Advisors will be like, no, don't waste your money. but maybe let's look forward to May. So coming back to you, Amanda, I know that you had some things that you wanted to talk about from April, but I don't know if you want to talk about that a little bit and then we can get into May.
Oh, I can do. Okay. I'll just sort of talk about one other feature. I looked at, should new entrants to financial advice self-fund their exams? I thought this was a really interesting one because it's common now to join a firm as an administrator and whatever, sort of get on that career pathway and your firm will pay. And, you know, this seems a kind of great thing to do, but not everyone does that. So I did some, you know, looking at people who self-funded and why. And it was interesting that one of the reasons that came out was control. You know, you get more control over your own destiny, I suppose, if you self-fund, because you could work for a firm who decides you're not ready, or they maybe don't have the money at that precise moment, or, you know, you're in a queue or whatever the reason might be. And they might just say, you know, we'll sort of put you through exams in 6 months' time or whatever. But, you know, if you're sort of desperate to do them and you want to get on, it's probably not, you know, not the greatest thing to be told, because one of our new columnists, Maria Taylor Beavis, is going to be writing for us, isn't he? I had a chat with him, and he's a very entrepreneurial kind of person. He always has been, and he put himself through his exams, and that was the very reason why. You know, he was told, you know, if you join us, we won't kind of, you know, put you through your exams straight away. And he was like, yeah, but I want to do it now. And it's interesting to kind of see his viewpoint, because he was also saying that you know, he set up his own business, and he was saying he'd met people that didn't have the sort of steeliness and grit that he has. And it's almost like, you know, having to self-fund it, you kind of become like that, because, you know, you've kind of made it on your own, as opposed to, you know, having it, you know, done for you. So I thought it was really interesting, because with my journalism exams, I self-funded my way through, but I was on a course with people who were part of big newspaper groups that got, you know, got funded for it. And I remember sort of looking at them, and I'm not saying they sort of didn't take it, they did take it very seriously, they had jobs and whatever, but I think we were very different beasts. So
I think I
can't really sort of say any more than that, but yeah.
No, definitely. I mean, looking at the way you write, it's evident. But I think I can relate to that with like my undergraduate degree, which I got a student loan, and student loans aren't like, they're not like American student loans where it's like it's crippling or anything. So I just did my undergraduate, and then when I was done with it, I was like, I'm not that interested in pursuing this as a career. But then when I went and did my master's, it was something that I had to self-fund. And I think I took it much more seriously because I was self-funding it, exactly. First of all.
Yeah.
And also, it just meant that I felt like I had to get out there and really show myself and do the work, because it was something that I was I was investing in myself for. And I think when you're investing in yourself, you believe it more. I think maybe something about that mentality of like, I'm investing in myself, I'm betting on myself, so I'm going to follow through with this.
So yeah, no, I like totally that. Agree. I definitely agree, because there was sort of, I did the same thing as you, basically. Undergraduate, yeah, it was loan driven, whatever, but yeah, I had to pay for myself for the other one. And it does focus the mind a bit. You're like, you know, if I sit and waste, you know, it was only a 9-month course I went on. It was like, if I waste even a month, I'm wasting my own money on this. So it kind of focuses the mind, I think.
Yeah. No more going to the pub afterwards or anything.
Well, exactly.
It was like, exactly. I'm going home to do my assignments.
but having said that, I suppose I want to make the point as well on that, you know, if times are financially tough now, so if you can get it paid for, you know, I don't blame anyone for doing it, because you know, it's a different time, you know, compared to when I was studying, whatever. So you know, if you can get it paid, you know, why not? So you know, that's the other thing to put in there.
I mean I had both sides, where the first half of my master's I paid for, and then I came across a bursary that was being awarded, and then I applied and I managed to get it, so then I was able to pay off the kind of money that I'd taken out to pay for the first half of my master's, and I was like, yes. But also but I still, again, there was something that I really wanted, I invested, so I really worked hard. But yeah, definitely go out there, Google, find ways to help with that funding. It'll also ease that burden of feeling like I have to work alongside doing this, which might be difficult, especially if you're an advisor doing exams, having to also like maybe have a full-time job alongside it. It might mean that you'll end up taking longer to qualify.
Yeah, it's all a balancing act, isn't it? And, you know, finding what's right for you. But should I talk about May now? Because I probably need to talk about May. I'm just going to sort of touch very briefly on what I'm doing in May. I'm looking at how advisors can tap in the market for grey divorce. Now, grey is defined by Legal & General as over 50. And you know, I creep closer to that age myself, I'm like, I'm not grey. But
grey,
you know,
I thought it meant like grey area. like you want a divorce, but you're not sure. I don't know.
No, grey hair, Kim. You're too young to have.
Yeah, I want grey hair.
There is that. I'm also doing something on whether there's a place for transactional advice, you know, one-off advice, you know, back in the old days kind of thing. So, you know, now with you know, the shift towards financial planning and long-term relationships, you know, do advisors want to engage on a one-off basis? You know, if they do, how can they, or do they just sort of turn these clients away? So I'm looking at that. And also a bit of a sort of sad subject as well for the focus on vulnerability. I'm looking at cognitive decline and got some quite sort of, you know, personal experiences in there which just sort of make you stop and think. So yeah, it's not an easy read, I don't think, but you know, it needs to be said. So
yeah,
that's what I'm doing in May.
It is a lot of people's realities, having to deal with family members who might be going through that, and yeah, also having to deal with like the paper side as well as the emotional side of it, I think is a lot. But yeah, it should be very interesting to read. So look out for that. Back to you, Maria. Is there anything that you wanted to highlight for May?
Yeah, I mean, as usual, we've got our excellent columnists covering a range of topics. Just going to flip through now. So we've got Robin Powell, an important warning on new active ETFs. Yeah, that's really interesting because there's been a burst of these active ETFs, and yeah, he's just as always casting a thorough analytical eye over it. We've also got a piece from advisor Tom Morgan about setting up his own company, so breaking free of dubious vertical integration and doing things my way. So there's some kind of insight into why he didn't like, you know, some of these big advice what are they called? Big advisor firms, you know, the vertically integrated firms. And then we've got a piece from Brian Burns, who's head of personal finance at Moneybox, and he's looking at the advice guidance consultation and saying how industry players, companies are going to have to put commercial interests on the back seat to get this right. So yeah, as always, some really good comment pieces worth checking out.
Exciting. And Dan, back to that cover that you and Lois worked on.
Yeah, it was we started something a little bit different for May, and it was kind of in recognition of Mental Health Awareness Month. So we looked at there were a few reports before the end of the year about, you know, advising mental health and the fact that a lot of them are at breaking point. And a big part of that, although it's, you can't, you know, attribute it completely to regulation, is regulation. You know, we've obviously had Consumer Duty under a year ago, and it kind of feels like since Consumer Duty's come in, the FCA have really kind of been going for it. You know, they've been hitting it hard, and obviously regulation is important, and it plays a big part in you know, edging out the bad eggs as such. It's it's having a huge impact on advisor mental health, and a lot of them, as I said, say they're at breaking point because of it. And there was a study recently, I think it's from the LANCAP, which stated that the fear of more regulation is keeping a third of advice business owners awake at night. So it's just really looking at, you know, the regulation, that's the regulatory changes and the proposals that have come in over the last kind of 6 to 9 months, and the impact that's having on people. So we, Lois, spoke to quite a few advisors on this, and we got some really kind of quite candid first-hand accounts of, you know, the personal struggles that many of the advisors are facing. And you know, particularly kind of the smaller to medium-sized advice firms, where, you know, they're under that constant pressure to keep up with the regulation and regulatory changes, but also, you know, the cost of implementing that and the extra kind of paperwork and hours that goes into doing that. So yeah, quite a powerful cover feature, I think. And it's just kind of looking at what can be done, and one of those things, because we kind of initially went on the regulation line, and that plays a big part in the cover feature. But one kind of unexpected thing that came out of the phone calls was a lot of the perhaps sort of more senior advisors who were around pre-RDR, perhaps fair to say from the conversation we had, feel like they're perhaps struggling a little bit more with the regulation, whereas a lot of the advisors coming into the industry, the thing that they said they're really struggling with more than most is the how close advice can get to therapy.
Okay.
So there was kind of the regulations one part of it, and the other part is kind of these conversations that, you know,
you have to get
their clients,
psychology, you know, degree to
exactly. talk to. Exactly. And, you know, unlike counsellors and therapists who are kind of trained to
compartmentalise
and deal with these conversations, and, you know, advisors don't really have that training. And so a lot of them are going into the profession and having these really kind of quite, you know, upsetting conversations sometimes around, you know, around sort of divorce and death and illness and so on, and it can, sometimes they can be the first person to speak to that client about you know, their issues. And so the second part of the feature is kind of looking at, well, what else can be done to I guess help advisors with that, and kind of build more resilience and prepare them for those difficult conversations. And one of the things we're looking at is, you know, some of the professional bodies such as the CLA and so on, whether, you know, they can implement some kind of training courses into their or segments into their training just specifically to kind of deal with this issue. So that was kind of the crux of the May cover.
Maybe they need to like set up like a company or something, or a service where advisors can then, after they've had like an intense meeting with their clients, then they can talk about it with a client. But then regulation, would they be allowed? Well, you can be like, oh, I had this really difficult day and difficult conversation. You don't have to get into the nitty-gritty, but yeah, because I feel like in other professions, you know, like I'm sure that when doctors are having to, and nurses and all medical practitioners, when they're having to break bad news, I think they probably do get that support to be like, if you need to talk to someone. Yeah, I never thought about that. But
no, it's just a side of it that, yeah, I kind of never thought about really either until, you know, the conversation started. I was like, actually, yeah, they kind of, you can kind of see that really with the conversations that you know, some advisors have. But yeah, it's just it's an interesting thing going forward. I know more is being done, and there are a few kind of webinars coming up about it and about, you know, how to deal with those conversations. But yeah, it's just something to sort of think about for the future, really.
Yeah. Well, we can look forward to that in May. Unfortunately, one thing we cannot look forward to in May is Money Marketing Interactive Leeds, which, if you don't know, has now been postponed to the 24th of October due to the railway strikes that are happening. All three lines that could possibly lead to Leeds have all been put on strike on that particular day. I don't know what luck we have, but yeah, I guess it just means that we have more time to marinate and make sure that it is the best event that it can be, and we hope that you are still with us and can come and join us and listen to some really engaging conversations. We're going to keep working on that agenda and make sure that it's up to date and everything that everyone wants to hear about when we are in Leeds. We also have Money Marketing Interactive London, if that would be closer for you. So that will also be happening in October as well. And we also have our amazing, fabulous awards in September. So look out for that. We're going to have a top heavy end of the year. But I guess that just means we're going out with a massive bang for 2024. But yeah. Thank you all for joining me today for today's end of month podcast. I really enjoyed this chat. And I will see you next month.
Thanks, Mom. Thanks, Kim.
Bye. Bye.